My name is Nels, and I am an alcoholic. I'm really glad to be here. I have no idea what I'm going to say. I tried everything on Heidi, and not everything. Let's not get... Of course. So you can see this is going to be a spiritual talk this morning. First of all, I'd like to thank Dell over there for calling me last year and telling me, he said, what are you doing May next year? I said, I don't know. He said, would you care to come to Tri-Cities? I don't know. I thought it was an obscene phone call. Then he explained AA and all that. So I want to thank you, Dell. I really do. And Heidi and Bob have been so wonderful and nice and friendly and everything. And this committee and this whole conference has just been outstanding. It's a move. Yeah, let's do it, man. There's a movie that I'm a big cowboy buff, so I'm really happy to see all you guys in cowboy hats and stuff like that. But there's a movie called Silverado, and during the movie, the guy walks into a saloon and kicks the door open, and he goes, I love the smell of a good saloon, you know. Well, I'm the same way. When I walked in here and met you guys, it was like, I love the smell of a good AA meeting. And you guys got it. I really mean it. What else am I going to say up here? A lot of people between me and the door, you know. I could put my all-in-on wife in front, but she's healthy now, so she won't do that for me. I would like to thank one person that we always forget. There's an unsung hero in this room right now. I hope he's in the room. You know, we got the chair people, and we got these people and that people. But there's a guy outside making coffee named Daryl. Yeah. Get out there. Daryl gave me $2 to say that. And a t-shirt. Is that humility? See, I couldn't do that. My ego is so big, I'd have the coffee maker right here in the middle of the room. I have sweat running down the middle of me going, yeah. I'll get it out here in a minute, please. Daryl's out there doing his thing. So I just want you to know, we can have everybody in the world, but no coffee maker, no AA meeting, far as I'm concerned. So anyway, thank you very much. The next person I'd really like to recognize, organize, whatever, is the gentleman with 4 days. Now, we're all important in here, but the 4 days... And he's sitting there thinking, this is good. I've been sober 4 days and 200 people love me. I hope before I'm done I explain to you that there's going to be, we're going to lie to you, but we're going to love you at the same time. You're going to hear things like, keep coming back, it gets better. And then at the end of your first year we'll say, no, we meant different. You know? This has really been great. I enjoyed Kena from Friday night. It was an awesome speaker, followed by Scraps. It was a fun thing. And the panels yesterday were great. Nobody called on me. I have no resentment. I'll get over it. And then last night's speaker, what can you say about him, Keith, that you can't? He was awesome. Matter of fact, he was so good, I ran up in my room and locked myself in the closet. So this is my first day out of the closet. No, I mean... Anyway, this is a program for anybody that's new, and I also like to say for anybody that feels new. I don't know about everybody else, we always talk, but there's a lot of us with time, and I have days when I come to a meeting that I feel new. I feel it ends, and not in working with my own self or you guys, and I need to go to a meeting sometimes, you guys, to remind me I belong. So, but I was thinking on the way over, the wife and I were talking. That's something we do now when we travel, we talk, you know. It's hard to, in the old days, it was hard to drive with that finger in your face all the time, you know. But now we've cleared that up. But anyway, you know, I remember traveling when I was drunk. I don't remember. She told me that I would go to strange towns. I'm sure I'm not the only one that's ever done this. You'd pull into a new town, and the first place I would go to a bar. And I walk in the bar with this great grandiosity because I'm from another town. I'm going to teach you. But inside it was this little guy saying, oh, God, I hope you don't know how scared I am. So I'd start drinking. And the first person after about 2 or 3 hours of drinking, of course, I'm buying the drinks because I need your friendship. And then after a while, I'd say to somebody there, where's a good place to get eat? Now, this guy's been drunk for 4 days next to me, right? He don't know where to eat. I said, where's a good place to sleep? He said, well, you can use the back seat of my car. I'm using the front seat. Well, the difference for me now is I come to different towns. I still travel. I still see a lot of people. But I go to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And I have yet to be to one where I wasn't welcome, where I wasn't loved, and I felt at home. And most of the people, not all, were not leaving their cars anymore. Not all, but some of us moved out. Anyway, I'd like to talk about, I guess, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I'm lucky I'm married to an Al-Anon, so I don't remember a lot of things. She does. So I'll probably just finish up her talk from yesterday. But, I was born there at a good start, an early age to boot. Then I went on a 13-year dry drunk. So I guess I had my first drink around 13. But my mom, my dad, my whole family are alcoholics. My dad died of alcoholism alone. He was a town drunk of a small town called Port Townsend. My mom drank until she said 10 years sobriety now. She's 80 years old. Isn't that neat, really? She doesn't go to meetings because she uses Oprah and Geraldo in the afternoon for her noon meetings. But she's read all the literature. My wife taught me how you leave literature around the house. That's an Al-Anon trick. I'll get into that later. But but it's nice now. The gift of Alcoholics Anonymous has been that I now can see my mom and we talk about the past where we never could talk. In our family, if you got an argument with somebody, you didn't talk for 5 years. Now, I would talk to an aunt, to an uncle, and they would talk to mom, and mom would talk back, you know, but never directly, you know, that drunkenness. When we had parties at our house, as I got older, we would be one-fifth per person. If there's 8 people coming, we had to have 8-fifths. Then we usually had 3 or 4 more in case we had a pig with us that drank too much, you know. And there are people that will overdo, but anyway, when I had my first drink, and I don't remember what it was. It was white clear in a bottle. I was at somebody's house. I can't tell you the street or the house or the kid's name, but I can tell you what happened when I had that drink. I drank it, and next thing I know, I was standing on top of his garage, a little short, fat kid looking over his domain. Yeah, this is my town. I felt different, you know. I felt like I was, you know, I could do things. See, in my family, because of the drunkenness, let me explain a couple of things about my family. I kind of jump around a little bit, so if you're looking for a timeline, we're in serious trouble. I am scattered. In my family, let me put it this way, alcoholism in my family is, if you shook our family tree, nothing but beer cans and wine bottles would fall out, okay? That explains everybody in our family was a drinker. I like to share about the time, and this is a few years in advance, but when I was in my early 20s, I was in the military, and I would come home on leave, and I always come home with a bunch of money and raise hell and drink, and my mom at that time became my best drinking partner, you know. She loved to go to town with her son and watch him fight, lay on the floor, puke, do all those kind of, that's my boy over there, you know. So one night, just to show you how insane my family was, one night we were out partying, and I got out in the street, in the main street of town, and I don't know, some words were said, and the fight started, and the cops came, and over there it's a small town, and if they know you, they just put you in jail overnight, you know, no big deal. So I went down to the jail, and they took me downstairs, and I heard this voice in the back, he's going to kick booty, and he's going to fight, he'll hurt you, and it was my father. And he had been in jail earlier, so he still had him, and I told the guard that I didn't really care to be in the same room with him, you know, can I have my own cell? And he said, fine. He understood, too. He knew my dad. And so I was sitting down there, and my dad was trying to give me fatherly advice from across the corridor from his cell to my cell about where I went wrong at. And then I hear a female voice and scream, ah, you don't do that to my son. Well, here comes mother. And she was drunk, and they put her in. Now, she doesn't go in the same cell with Dad either, because none of us like Dad, so Dad's by himself. Mom was rooming with me. That happened. Then pretty soon I hear another female voice. And she's also going to rip his lips off and take his eyes out and shoot marbles. Yeah, you know, and it was my Aunt Cotton. She had come down to rescue us. Now, Aunt Cotton come down. She doesn't speak to my dad at all, so she joined us on our side, our suite. Anyway, thank God my family has been ravaged by alcoholism. There wasn't many of us left. And time went by, and I hear this stumbling down the hall. It's my Uncle Dewey. And they had got him on a DUI leaving town. This is embarrassed. I don't know. So they brought Dewey down, and that was our first Chalene family reunion. We haven't had many since then. Because alcohol, except for my mom, alcoholism has killed all the rest of them. Every one of them died in the throes of alcoholism. I grew up in a crazy family, like I say. My first drink, I'm not going to go drink by drink and all that. But when I was in high school, I really enjoyed drinking. It became quite the thing for me. Not knowing at that time it was totally out of control, that I had, I was doing it because I had no other choice. I thought I was still in control. And I was what you call a pig drinker. And I'm the kind of drank to get drunk, period. You know, I may look at the label and go, that's good stuff, but I didn't care. I wanted inside the bottle, you know, I didn't care about it. And I'd get dead drunk, and I'm the guy, you all drank with me, I'm the guy that puked in your car, started a fight and left you there. insulted your parents or your girlfriend or whatever. I'm the one that, oh God, I see a green plant. Oh man, I used to go to people's houses, and if they had green plants, I knew I hadn't been there before because I had a habit of urinating in plants. I don't know where that came from in the family tree. I did one of those family things, and none of us were, you know, into horticulture or nothing. So I don't know. But anyway, so, you know, that kind of drinking, and in high school, I made it through. I could tell you some war stories, but I just drank and did what I had to do, and because my family understood drinking. You know, when they would bring me home, my mother would say, don't let that happen again, and if you do what you need to do, here's a lawyer, and, you know, she was really good about teaching me responsibility. I wrecked two or three of her cars in the process. It was insane. Then I went in the military, and I did 20 years in the Coast Guard. I'm not blaming, again, like my family. I don't blame my family. I learned to drink there, and I watched the drinking, but I chose to drink. Nobody ever held me down and poured booze or dope in my mouth. I took it. But in the military, I found a great club. People there, they drank. If you didn't drink, you were weird. People wouldn't talk to you. What's wrong with that guy? He doesn't drink. I don't know. Something scary there. You know? And I drank my way through the military. It was great. I had no responsibilities. I was single. It was a great life. Matter of fact, I have stacks of albums at home now. And when my kids were growing up, they would say, Daddy, can we go through your albums? I go, sure. Where's that? I don't know. What's that? I don't know. But I was lucky that I had kids that worked for me that would take pictures, and they would label them. So I go, yeah, that's Amsterdam, Holland. Yeah, looks like it anyway. I don't know. I never got past the first bar. I would get off the ship, run across the dock, wow, I'm in a foreign country. Can I have a Budweiser? You know, that was it for me. Made friends with the locals really quick. Yeah, I got money. Got in a lot of trouble. Throughout my career of drinking, I ran into what I call forks in the road, or areas where people noticed my drinking and would talk to me about it, but I didn't get it. I remember one time my first ship was a little buoy tender out of Astoria, Oregon, and I was on there, and I was running with a bunch of other guys. I went in when I was 17. I was running with a bunch of guys, and we'd go up, and has anybody raised in Astoria? Good, because I used to chase the girls there, and I want to tell the rest of this story. I just don't, I don't want to have to make amends up here in front of God and everybody, but anyway. So we used to, you know, in one car, nine of us, and a case or two of wine, and we would meet the local high school girls, and we'd go up in the hillside and drink. But because I couldn't drink, I didn't know how to handle, or whatever. Like I said, as a pig drinker, pretty soon those guys told me one day they were all ready to go ashore, and I said, wait for me, and they said, no, Nels, we don't want you to go with us anymore. And I said, what do you mean? He said, you don't drink like we do. He said, we get up on the hillside, and we want to, you know, talk a little trash to the girls. You want to break windows, punch people, urine, and then you're up in the woods with a lot of urination places, you know. It's almost like you're on a mission. But, you know, so even at that level, I didn't fit. But luckily with drinking, there's always another group you can go to. There's always one more bunch you can kind of join and belong. And I did that throughout. I guess the next biggest thing for me was, I don't know, I was about 27, 28 years old, and I ended up going to the Far East and doing a thing over there. And I wasn't, I guess one thing I want to tell you before, I'm kind of getting mixed up here, and I'm not nervous, nothing like that. The guy with 4 days is taking less than I am, for Christ's sake. But I always wanted to be somebody. I always wanted to be a man. I always wanted people to look up to me and respect me from when I was a little kid all the way up. And I found out, and I don't know, some people may think this is sick or whatever, but I found out when I drank, I became that man. And the crazier I was, the more people talked about me. Now, it was sick stuff. Like, do you remember what you did last night? Do you know what you did last night? And that, to me, was like the award. Now, they were looking at me like, do you know what you did? What I heard was, wow, are you cool? You know? So I found, and I don't like doing things like that. When I got sober, I found out there's a real tender guy inside of here. There's a real scared person inside here. But with alcohol, I found out I could do things that I normally wouldn't do. So I found myself insulting, fighting, going to jail, breaking things, you know, doing those things. And then next day on the ship or wherever in my life, people go, wow, do you remember? Of course I say, yes, but I don't. I can remember one time getting put in the back of a paddy wagon. And all the way in, man, I had those shore patrol upside down. They had cuffs on me, and I had cuffs on them, and we were turning knots upside down. They got inside that wagon. They slammed that door. And nobody was there but me, and I started crying. Sergeant, I didn't mean any of that. I was scared to death. As long as I had the audience out there, as long as people were looking up to me, I'd have killed somebody if they'd have let me. I'd have done anything they asked of me, so I thought what I was doing is matching my insides to your outside, or my, yeah, whatever. I was trying to be something that I couldn't be, and I thought you wanted to be, wanted me to be. So I kept using alcohol for that. So I ended up going to Vietnam, and I wasn't a patriot. I went because I was scared that somebody else would go and come back and tell me about it. Me, the man's man. So I volunteered to go. I did three tours over there, again, not because I was a patriot, because they had 40 ounces for $3.50, and you could buy a joint as big as your thumb for a nickel. I mean, and you could carry a grenade launcher and a pistol. You couldn't do that in Seattle in those days, you know. I guess you can do it now, but... So anyway, I stayed over there. And then I came back, and I just, like I say, I just traveled and went. And the main part I like to talk about in my talk, and I like to talk a lot about sobriety, but is I come from the family side, because in my alcohol, my drunkenness, I really devastated the family. When I was 30, I don't know, 30 years old or so, I was going down the street, and my wife was coming up the street, and like radar, we locked on each other. You know, my thinker was broken, her picker was broke. You know, I can't think past my nose, and she can't pick husbands. So we met, and it was an automatic thing. We dated, we were crazy, I was. I think she should have known, like she said yesterday, the Al-Anon thing. I proposed on top of a grease rack in a car, you know. Went to a bar, and I don't know anybody in, and I told everybody in the bar, man, I got engaged. And the guy says, who gives a shit? And I punched him. The fight was on. The cops came. She should have known right then and there that this was not going to be a normal relationship, you know. But anyway, we got married, and Nancy had a little daughter named Angie, who I adopted, and my dearest darling, Angie. And we went on to have two more children, James and Stephanie, and I kept on drinking. Now my wife, like she said, she just figured if she could just get something for me to do or find something to help me out, I would probably quit drinking. And being a manipulator like I am, I worked that to the bone. You know? Like one time we were talking and she says, why don't you quit drinking? What would make you stop? I said, golf. Even God gives drunks inspirations, you know. She said, golf? I said, yeah, you see him out there in slacks, nice shirts, hitting the ball. If I could do that, they don't drink. And everybody looked at Don. I don't want to say anything. So somewhere we were living hand to mouth. I didn't know it. I thought we were independently wealthy. You know, we always had money. We always had everything. I didn't know that she was selling things. She was material things. And it's going to be a long ride home. You know, she was going without, the kids were going without, but the primary mission in her life was to have everything ready to go when I got home, because I would be home for 3 weeks, 4 weeks, 5 weeks, whatever, and I partied when I was home. We had people over our house, we went to other people's house, we always had money, and I never thought once where it came from. I just thought that's the way it was, because my money when I was sailing was my money. The money I sent home or she got by allotment was my money. You know, I never entered my mind. I just kept traveling. So we would just party, stay drunk, do have good times, and I never realized. I went to sea, and I didn't until sobriety realize that some of my children had broken legs and were in hurt and stuff, and she would take care of that stuff. And when I came home, it better be good, and maybe some of the children would be in trouble or have, you know, in school or something. Oh, it's okay. Man, we're going here. We're going. I was always the big guy. Everybody in the family loved me. Except for hangover mornings. I don't know about you guys, but we used to have these things on the weekend where I'd get drunk on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, and I'd get home Saturday, whatever. And then Sunday, I'd wake up with this god-awful, terrible remorse hangover. And I'd get up, and I'd feel guilty, but my first suggestion was always, let's go for a ride. And everybody doesn't want to go. Oh, I see. It's Sunday, my day off, and nobody wants to do anything. Okay, now these kids and my wife had been through these rides before. They knew it was going to be brutal. They knew it was torture. It was not going to be fun, you know. But in my simplistic mind, so we would go for our Sunday ride, which meant we'd get in the car, and I would tell everybody, this is going to be fun, right? No answer. This is going to be fun, isn't it? Oh, yes, Daddy, it's going to be fun. And we'd start off, and then pretty soon one of the kids would move in the back seat. I'd knock Dad off, or I'm coming back there and rip your ears off. Pretty soon we'd go a little farther, and she'd say, shut up. And pretty soon everybody in the car is fighting. And then pretty soon, you probably saw it, long I-5. Poor woman, three kids in the car, and one idiot outside ranting, raving, hitting the roof. What do you want from me? Jesus, I take you for a ride. Does anybody have any respect? Does anybody care? All right, let's go home. If you guys can't cut this, I'm not staying out here and give up my valuable time. And what does it say in the book about self-centered? Huh? Man. Well, as time went on, I ended up, and we grew, and there was some bad scenes, and we got into some pretty heavy fighting. And one time we got in a big fight. Oh, God, it was terrible. And I came home, and she accused me of drinking. Whoa, where'd you get that one from? But so she said something, I don't know, I said, I don't need this. I lived on the ship then. See, I had a cook on the ship, and I had somebody do my laundry, and I was a chief petty officer. I had my own stateroom on the ship. I don't need this. I'm out of here. So I'd make a drink to leave, and I went and got my clothes, and I threw them in the back of the car, and then I'd come in, and she made me a drink. Oh, honey, let's talk, and I'd get some more clothes, and she'd go out and bring the clothes back in. You know, this is 3 a.m, neighbors are going, there they are, isn't that fun? Look at those two over there, you know. But anyway, so finally I made the big move. I'm out of here. I'm going home. I'm back to the ship, I mean. And I left, and I'm flying down through Redmond, Washington, and it's a bunch of street lights, and I happen to look in the rearview mirror, and it's a bra flapping. And I went, what the hell? I picked up her clothes. Now, they talk about that moment of clarity to get sober. How about that moment of clarity when you got a trunk full of women's clothes and you're going back to your ship? So Oh, there you have to pull the car over the side of the road, think it out. Geez, should I go back or shouldn't I go back? I don't think it's my size. I don't know what to do. Well, anyway, I turned around, went home, made amends. Drunken amends. I'm sorry, it'll never happen again. I promise. Cut my wrist. Oh, I'm sorry. You know. Anyway, so my tour in the service was up. Our 20 years was up. And the reason I got out was because they were changing. They no longer allowed us to drink like we used to. They actually wanted us to be responsible. I said, I don't need this. I'm getting out. Nobody said nothing. I thought they'd say, wait a minute, it's going to fall apart without you, you know. So I did 20 years, 14 days, and I got out. And I thought, well, now I got a whole new world. My wife and I talked a little bit about the fact that everything's going to change now, and we're going to be better off. And it didn't work that way. We had more fighting. You civilians could really drink. I was really impressed. And I started really drinking. I got into two or three different businesses. I opened up a janitorial service, and within a couple months, it was one of the bigger ones in Seattle. I mean, it was awesome. But then we lost the contract. I was in bars giving the keys away to these major buildings, you know. Somebody said they didn't have a job. Well, here's a key. Go down and clean that building, you know. I'm my own boss and stuff. Well, we started losing contracts. So, and then pretty soon, we lost another business and another business. Then I went into real estate. I did okay until I sold somebody's house that didn't want theirs sold. I got a good price for it. But it was insane. It was insane. You know, I was top. I picked the real estate office that had three people there. Yeah, four people, counting myself. And I was top salesman for 6 months in a row. And every month, our boss, who was an alcoholic, would take us out to celebrate top salesmen. I had not sold anything in 6 months, but I was the last guy in our office to sell anything. So therefore, I was still on the list, and every month we'd go out, and I was still top salesman, you know. And we drank at 8 o'clock in the morning. You know, we'd start drinking all day. We did all that. But the part that, not the most fun part to talk about, but I know I'm not the only person in this room that's had this. As the last years of my drinking started coming around, I started losing everything. I lost that stuff that keeps you going, that last value. I don't believe you can be married to alcohol and have other values and beliefs. You start selling them out pretty soon. And I was raised, you don't steal from your friends. You know, you always do an honest day's work. You never hit a woman. You never hit children. By the time I had my last drink, I had done all of those. I was stealing at the bars I was going to. I was stealing from my kids. I remember one time I took my kids' Spider-Man bank, you know, Spider-Man head bank, and I took it to the bar and cut it open with a knife, and we all drank on the change all night long, and everybody thought it was wonderful, you know. I started stealing at work. I wasn't stealing, I was borrowing. Actually, I wasn't borrowing, I was reinvesting. I also had a gambling problem, and I would take the money out of my boss's safe and go down to Long Acres and reinvest it in horses. And being a good drunk, I always had that, I'll pay him back as soon as I hit big. And I never hit big. And if I did hit big, it would take me all that money to drink my way back to my house, and I'd be broke. So I was stealing there. And then I was starting to scream, and the verbal abuse had risen past the normal level, not normal, that level we lived in, to the point that I was physically hitting my wife, shaking her. I remember when I first came into AA, I'd shake my wife, but not hard. Come on, people. I'm a big man. I grabbed my kids, man, 7, 8 years old. The oldest one was 13. I'd shake her and him. You know, can you imagine a man my size and your little people? I love my children. I love my wife. But the problem is with the insanity of drinking. See, I wasn't allowed in any bars anymore. One bar let me in. I could have two beers and I had to leave. You know? No money. No nothing. I had nothing working for me. The shame, the guilt, you know. That bottom me, it hit. But I didn't have anywhere to take it out. I took it home. So the people that loved me the most, I took it home. And it kept going, getting crazier and crazier until Thanksgiving Day, 1980s, when I had my last drink. And it was not a choice thing. My wife and I were, it was Thanksgiving Day, and we kind of disagree on exact events. I think I was drunk 10 days. She says 12, but, you know, that's her opinion. But I use humor a lot in this period because I'm not happy at all about it. I mean, it happened. You live it, you do it. But sometimes when you have to go back, it's tough. I'm going to tell you, I'm going to jump ahead real quick here because when I was sober 3 years, my wife was in Al-Anon, and we had two of our children. The two youngest ones were in Alateen. And they'd asked them to speak at the Alateen speakers at the Everett Conference. You know, and I said, right on, you know, my kids are speaking. See that ego? You know, they're speaking, but I'm going on with Father, you know. And if you ever think drinking and being drunk is fun, and talk to your kids sometime and ask them what it's like. So I said to them, you know, when you're speaking, I'll leave the room and go out in the hall and have a cigarette or whatever. And they said, no, Dad, you can come in and listen. Of course, then my ego jumped up. Ooh, everybody's going to hear about this dad. He's so cool, and he takes them here, and he takes them there. Sometimes in Alateen, they work the first step for a long time. And to sit in a room like this size and, you know, way in the back, say, I want to, you know. And to listen to your daughter talk about waiting to see if Mr. Good Drunk or Mr. Bad Drunk came home. I never knew this. But see, I knew I was, you know, even in sobriety, I knew it was crazy and the stuff I did. But I didn't know the depth. And she'd talk about it at night, laying at night, her and her brother in the bedroom, waiting to see if Mr. Good Drunk or Bad Drunk come home. And if Mr. Bad Drunk came home, or Mr. Good Drunk came home, she was honest. She worked on an honest program. They'd come out and hustle me for money and sign papers, report cards. You know, they were working. I don't know who taught them that, but they were working. But if Mr. Bad Drunk came home, see, and I never knew this. They had a routine. My son would go in the closet and close the door, and my daughter would crawl in the bed. Because they knew that there's a good chance with all the ranting and the raving and me and her fighting out there, and it got physical. You know, and I've been known to throw chairs against the wall. I mean, I've been known, like I say, I'm really, you know, I hit my wife. Sooner or later, if I didn't get sidetracked, I'd end up in one of their bedrooms screaming and hollering about a skate left out or something not done. You know, and snatch them out of bed and scream at them. And again, like I say, this is not a highlight of a person's life. Anyway, so sometimes sit there, and after the thing was over, the two kids got a standing ovation. And the lights came on, and I heard a voice say, that must be the father over there in the corner crying. You know, those tears, honest to God, cleansing to know that. But you know, it happened. Anyway, on Thanksgiving Day, we were sitting around having a breakfast, and we were going to go over to my mother's house for Thanksgiving, which usually meant roast leg of whiskey. And what a sight of Rainier. Something happened. I can't tell you the words. I can't tell you what happened. All I know is that Stephanie, the middle child, said something. I reached across the table and hit her. She went, I started screaming and yelling. I turned the table over, and I jumped in this beat-up old pickup I had, and I left. I don't need this. They don't understand how important I am. I have business things going on. I have to go see my mother. And I realized I had nowhere to go for the first time in my life. I'm a con man. I'm a thief by nature. And for the first time in my life, I had nowhere to go. So I came back home, and my wife said, your daughter, Angie, our oldest, was in the bathroom trying to kill herself. You know, my people skills, my parenting skills, aren't very good at that time. So I kicked the bathroom door open and drug her out by her hair, you know, screaming at her. Walked her around the backyard, and she said to me, I said something to her that changed my life. And I like to say I said it, but I think God used me in the middle to say it. He said, Angie, if you'll never do suicide again, I'll never drink again. And she said, you mean that? My mouth said yes. My brain said, you shitting me. And I, because as an alky, I've made those words before 1,000 times. Anyway, get going along here. So we got her in the hospital, you know, and one thing I'll never forget, there's certain parts that I just never, ever want to revisit again. And one of them was she was on the gurney or in the emergency room there, and they were sure she was going to make it. And I remember thinking, either die or get well. I got to get a drink. I was hurting so bad. I just wanted out of that hospital, you know. Yet I love that woman. I love her totally. But the booze own me. The booze love me, I guess. Anyway, 2 weeks I don't drink. You know, I'm looking good. I already stole a checkbook from her. I got two of her credit cards going, and I know where the kids' bank's at. I'm going back out. I'm not staying sober. It's just a promise. What do they mean? My daughter comes home. You know, short women have a lot to do with my life. My wife is short. my daughter's short, and later on you'll hear about two other short women that had a lot to do with my life. But she came home from school, and she's heading up to her room. I said, where are you going? She says, I'm going to my room to commit suicide. Jesus, do what? She said, I'm going to commit suicide. She says, because you're not doing anything about your drinking. These kids nowadays, they go to school, they don't learn the stuff I learned. They learn words like treatment, Alcoholics Anonymous. I wish she'd have said the F word, you know? And I said, what do you mean? And she says, you need to go do something about your drinking. And I said, all right, I'll do something, you know, I'll just go away, you know. And I don't know what AA is. I can be honest with you. I've heard the jokes in the bar about AA, but I don't know what it is. All I know, you ever take a cat and a dog that's never seen a cat, and the dog's never seen a ketamine, and a dog, and you put them together, they know they don't like each other, right? Instinct. When she said AA, I knew I wasn't going to like it. Never been there, but I just, something in my body said, this is not good for you, Nels. And treatment meant inpatient. I thought, you know, I'm too important to my family and my children and my business, so I can't go there. But anyway, I ended up going to a treatment center in Linwood, and I went up and got an evaluation, and the lady said to me, you're a drunk. And I guess I had answered those little questions right for a change. And she said, I said, I am. Oh, my God, I forgot. I got to tell this. Is okay if I go back a little bit about guerrilla warfare? Does anybody know what guerrilla warfare is? Alan Honor's dead. They know what it is. Before the last 6 months I was drinking, my wife was not in Al-Anon, but knew some Al-Anon people. That's just as dangerous because it's catchy, you know. I could go to the bathroom. I don't mean to be crude, but I like to read in the bathroom, you know. I go to the bathroom and there's nothing in there, a little outdoor life. This is this thing about, is AA for you? Do you have a drinking problem? Yeah. She gave me the two drink tests. Challenged me one night and said, you can't quit drinking. Yes, I can. She said, you just can't have two and walk away. Somebody taught her this, you know. And I said, I can have two anytime I want and quit. So the next night I come home, brand new fifth of whiskey. She says, have your two drinks. I said, no problem. I poured one, drank it. It's like 6:30 in the evening. Whoa, you know. And two drinks definitely ain't enough, you know. So anyway, the next night I come home, and she says, two drinks. I said, no problem. I got them big jelly jars out. Third night I come home, she says, two drinks. And I said, you know, I'm calling this off because it's stupid. I've proved my point. I'm right again, so I'm out of here, you know. She always says that the next thing was the flower vases to make two in. But anyway, right before I got sober, I had a little habit of keeping a pint of rum, real heavy dark rum, out in my back room for just those emergency mornings that you need that powerful stuff, you know, to get that heart started. Not the lightweight stuff, the good stuff. And one morning I got up and I was just devastated. My whole body ached, everything, and I went out to my back room. Now, I dressed up pretty, my wife said today, I cleaned up pretty nice, but, you know, I'm out there in my bathrobe. I'm not pretty. I got tattoos all over. I'm out there. I'm under the bench. I pull out this pint, and taped to the pint is 20 questions if you're an alcoholic. Now here's the insanity of our disease. I stood there in my underwear and a coat and cold in the morning taking the test, drinking out of a pint. Huh? And getting a lot of no's. Nah, not me, not me. And I just like to share that because, you know, sometimes when we get started early enough by just putting, you know, the straw that broke the camel's back ain't always the first straw. I mean, the last straw. Sometimes the first straw. And by her doing that kind of stuff and changing some of the rules of our house, I think it all helped me get to where I needed to go. Anyway, this lady was going to put me inpatient treatment, and I said, I ain't going, blah, blah, blah. She said, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll give you a chance. I said, what's that? She said, you go to AA two times a day. You sign in. She told me where to go, the old Ed Lynn. And Ryan knows what I'm talking about. And the old Ed Lynn Hall. And she said, you sign in. I'm checking every day. And if you're not there, she said, there'll be a white van from American Lake Veterans, and they're going to take you to inpatient. Oh, Jesus. So I started going twice a day, you know. Found out later she couldn't do that. Short lady tricked again. But I want to tell you something. You know how many white vans there are? I was like Pavlov's dog. White van, AA. But anyway, thank God, you know, because it turned out to be the biggest thing ever. It was I got there, I wasn't happy to be there. I'd never seen so many sick people in one room in my life. You guys have cleaned up pretty well, too, I want to say. I remember my first meeting, I don't mean to be crude or nothing like that, my sponsor later asked me, I told him I wasn't an alcoholic. And he said, you're not. And I said, no, I've been thinking about it. And he said, what do you remember from your first meeting? See, sponsors remember stuff from years ago. Don't tell them nothing you don't want them to remember. They bring it out of the clear blue sky. And he said, what do you remember from your first meeting? I said, I remember there's a guy who had tattoos like me. Another guy used to shit his pants in the garage. He said, most normal people do not remember those highlights from a meeting, you know. Okay. Well, anyway, I stayed in AA, but I did it through osmosis. I hung at the chairs. You know, I wanted to run things. Matter of fact, there's another bad part. I stole from the basket for the first couple of months. Every time, not every time. See, right away, I'm qualifying. Not every time. Sundays I didn't steal because I had this, I'm in a program now. But when the basket went by, I'd pretend like I was making change and I'd take $2 or $3 out every time. So you go to 2-3 meetings a day, that's $6, $8, $9. Hell, I'm doing better than I was in real estate, you know. But see, the secret to this whole thing is you people loved me enough to let me do that. Nobody made a production, nobody come over and accused me or screamed. I found out later everybody knew I was stealing. It was people putting extra in for the guy over there. That's the love of this program. You see, outside this program, we would have got there and jumped on him, had him to jail. You're a loser. I already knew I was a loser. I needed you to love me. And you did that. You took me in and said, do what you got to do. Get to where you got to go. But we'll hang on to you during that trip. And you did. Finally, you know, I make a line getting carried away. How much time I got? Because I'll talk to him about tomorrow. But anyway, I got in there, and I did it without... just doing, just showing up and stealing. And after about 3 or 4 months, our daughter ran away. The one that tried to kill herself ran away. Now, how dare she do that? I'm sober now, you know. Jesus, try my wife. Yeah, just starting. You know, it wasn't an Al-Anon yet. No. And I had to take care of that myself. But she ran away, and I went down to the hall after the second day, and there was a girl there, school teacher Elizabeth, little short girl. And I went in, I said to one of the big rough guys, I said, oh, my daughter ran away, what do I do? Well, you know, not all of us are psychologists. He said, oh, what step you on, boy? I don't know. He said, go see school teacher Elizabeth. She deals with kids. So I went over to see her. Oh, mean lady. I told her what was going on, and she just pushed me against the wall, and this hall was big and open, and it was no like little quiet rooms, and she said, did you sexually molest her? And I, no. She said, did you throw her out? No. Did you hit her? No. She said, well, it sounds like her problem. She said, now what about you? And I'm looking around, people are starting to pull up, you know, and I like to be the center of attention, but this is not the way I planned it. And I said, what do you mean? She says, you got a sponsor? No. She said, you ever been to Big Book Study? No. She said, how about a step study? No. I went down this list. I didn't bring it with me. It was on the back of a AA program. She wrote out 9 things I needed to do. And she says, matter of fact, why don't you just go out and get drunk? Now, you know, I've been planning on leaving AA on my terms. But now that she wants to kick me out, I'm staying, you know? Typical alcoholic, right? We ain't never happy. Anyway, this woman, school teacher Elizabeth, God love her. So she gave me this list of things to do. And at the bottom it says, if all these fail, please call me. You know, I guess she probably realized there's a chance. This one may not make it. Anyway, so I started going to these different things and doing these things. I have a little thing that I really believe in. You know, it's like AA is like a submarine. It's okay to be on the submarine when the weather's good. But when the weather gets crappy and that submarine goes under the water, you better be in the submarine. And I think AA is the same way. On the program's fine, but when it gets crappy and you better be in the program. And I truly believe that. Anyway, I ended up starting to do things, and I started feeling better about myself. And in the meantime, I went home, and my wife and I got in a big fight. And I told her, I guess she tells me, I don't remember, that she needed to grow or I had to go. So we got her into Al-Anon. Boy, that was neat to see, man. Took her to a meeting. They had two of them AA in one room and Al-Anon in the other. And of course, I didn't call ahead and tell anybody to get them ready. Yeah, I did. Man, I bought her in. About 2 or 3 gray-haired old ladies was on her like seagulls on a Dipsy dumpster, man. Boom, boom, she was gone, man. She was gone. She didn't like it. She didn't like Al-Anon to start with. Because I think it was a control thing, you know. But anyway, but we both started working programs together. I went to this list that said, go to the Big Book Study at 5 o'clock on Thursday. So I went. And there was a guy in front of the room up there, and he was a big guy, big man. Ex-pro football player, I found out later. And he's talking, and he wasn't yelling, he wasn't screaming, and everybody loved him. I could tell it. You ever been in a room and somebody's got respect and people like him? I kept going, wow, that's what I want to be when I grow up, just like him. Wow, I said, Dave, he has sponsor stuff. So I got up, and after the meeting, and I said, hi, Dave, my name's Nels. And he said, Nels, yeah, Elizabeth told me, I'm going to be your sponsor. Well, that was taken out of my hands. And then, of course, being a liar like I am, he said to me, now, one of the things I demand out of you, which I didn't like that word right away, but he's big, and I'm going to go with it for a while. And he said, I want service work. Now, I don't even know what service work is, but being a liar, I said, yeah, me too. That's important. And he said, but I said, what do you mean? He said, you know, secretary in a meeting, chair, you're giving out, doing something. And I said, well, and we had a big board there. And I said, there's no opening. He went over. Right, took his name off, put my name in. Thank you. I became a secretary of a meeting, you know, and all of a sudden I belonged with you people. See, now, before I was on the outside, looking in, taking your inventories, figuring out who's who, who's a loser, worried about that money that kept going in the back room. I know if I could just get to be president of this thing, I could get back there where the money was. So I'm going to share a few other things here, you know, and then... But Dave got me going. Dave started working on a really important part of my program, and I love it. It's spirituality of the program. I always thought it was religion, you know. I always thought this God thing was not for me, you know. He's got a lot of bad things. He's killing a lot of people, and he's doing a lot of things. And plus, he was not fitting in my life. I cannot drink and drug and have God. It's an impossibility for me, you see. So I had to start finding things out wrong with him so I could get rid of him and send him down the road. And I did that pretty good, actually. Well, they started discussing spirituality with me and having to get outside myself and the steps and stuff. And I like it in the second step where he talked about insanity. And I thought, well, I know insanity. I have been in two mental institutions in my life. I know it's hard to believe, but, you know. They were just short stays. See, right away, I qualify everything. I wasn't there that long. Just enough time to meet Napoleon and Jesus Christ. Both of them were there at the same time. That's funny about going to a nut farm. You meet some great people. Sometimes three and four are the same person, but anyway. And they just give you Thorazine and make moccasins all day. This is good, you know. See, but then they sober you, they cleanse you of the drugs, and they send you back out because they know nothing about alcoholism. They don't turn you over to the people that know, you know, the choir here. No, they just throw you back out. I was drunk before I got back to the ship. Anyway, I got into the program, started doing this stuff, and started learning about spirituality. But I'm a tester. You see, I test. I don't just jump in. So I used to go to I had a new home group on Thursday nights that I stopped by the Safeway and I'd buy a lottery ticket. And I would take my 3-month coin or whatever, and I'd go to an AA meeting in a church and I'd scratch it off figuring now that I don't win, there ain't no God. Don't ever share that with your sponsor. Because we went from lottery money to pay back what you stole. I don't know how we jumped that quick, but we did. We ended up having to go back, and I was standing up at those meetings sometimes, and you really think your hip's looking cool, and you're better than everybody else, when you stand up amongst you people and look you in the eye and say, I've been feeling this from you for quite a few months now, and I'd like to pay it back. And then have everybody come up and hug you afterwards and say, right on. That's the nice part. Anyway, we got it. Daughter ran away again. Called my sponsor. Sponsor said, meet me at a restaurant. Bring your wife, too. We went to the restaurant. There was a table full of people. I went up to them and said, you know, let's go in the back room so I can talk. And he said, no, sit down here so we can talk. Hadn't learned those key words yet. And I said, no, you know, my daughter ran away and I need to talk. And he said, no, you need to sit down where we can talk. So we sat down and he had called several AA people that had children run away in sobriety. And some of them left work and came to that restaurant and they sat around with us. Not one of them told us what to do. They just shared what happened to them. Is that love? That's it. I mean, I sat there and I started crying. I mean, Nancy, we both sat there and said, this is awesome. People giving like that. I've never seen people give like that. Anyway, so we got through that crisis and got moving on. And Dave, I'd share, I'm running out of time, and got doing the steps with him. And like Dave told me, he said, you need to get spirituality. He said, you need to learn how to get out of you into them. And I said, how do you do that? He said, try this. He said, you're having trouble at work. I had a new job by then. And he said, you haven't come at home. He said, pray for those people. Do what? He said, pray for those people. No, I said, pray for me, you know, not for them. Anyway, he said, you pray for them. I said, okay. A week later, we went to dinner like we always did on Thursday night, having dinner. He said, you look good. I said, I'm sleeping, man. He said, what are you praying for? I said, I'm praying they die, the house burns down. Man, I'm feeling good. We had a deal between my sponsor and I when we hit a stuck point, which means I was not agreeing with him. We would get in his car, and we would go up I-5 or south on I-5, and we'd do 60 miles an hour. He'd lock the doors, and we would discuss what we had, my problem. And then we finally got around to his way of thinking. We'd turn around and come back. We may have to Bellingham that night on spirituality. You know, that man, I love him. I love him like a father. I love him like a brother. I love him like my best friend. That man has been part of our family. He has moved now, and I have selected a new sponsor. There's something smart for a guy to do. Spend a year looking for a new sponsor. You know how good we are. I got him, man, he's okay, but he's not this. So that one's all right. And this one won't appreciate me. So anyway, I went up to teacher Tom. I had forgot he's a step Nazi. You know? I said, Tom, I'm looking for a sponsor. He said, I'd be honored. He said, what step are you on? I said, well, you know, I've been in a lot of years. I'm not really on any certain step. He said, what step are you on? And I said, no, Tom, you don't understand. I've got about 14, 15 then, I guess, years of sobriety. And I said, I'm really doing all the steps. So he said, let's start. So we did the steps again. God love him. That's the love in this program. Since those days, I got lucky and went back to college. Got a degree, a little two-year degree. I shouldn't say little. God love. I mean, from where I came from to what I got, 10 years later, the college brought me back. And I don't mean this bragging, brought us back is what I'm trying to say. It honored me as a distinguished alumni, you know? And I got to share one thing before I do that is I had to go back and make amends first. See, when I was going through school, I used to go to my classes right before finals and say, excuse me, sir or ma'am, yes. I don't know if you know it, but I'm a recovering alcoholic. And that test tomorrow may make me drink. Oh, you're going to boom like you wouldn't do it? You guys are just booing because you didn't think of it. It's an honest program. But anyway, and I did. And they'd say, well, they don't know nothing about it. And I'd be giving that look. You know, you've all done it. They'd say, well, I'll tell you what, you're getting a B in the class anyway. We'll just waive the test. I'd say, oh, man, thanks, because I don't want to relapse the three kids, the wife. So when they called me up, I did all my amends, not all, a lot of my amends, and I left that area out. But God has a sense of humor, you know. I guess nobody's noticed it. And in your lives, think about it. And when this distinguished alumni thing came out, I was telling my sponsor about it, and he said, and I, again, memory of an elephant, he said, she's gave you a chance to go back and talk to them teachers and tell them how you cheated them and manipulated them. I said, well, you know, I'm distinguished alumni now. He said, doesn't matter. So I went back to the ones that were still there and told them. I said, you know, I really, they didn't care. They didn't know how to remember me. But the bottom line is I did it. It was good for me. You know. So anyway, we got through that. And I'd like to share a little bit, and I'll wrap her up here, is that since those days, my wife and I are now still married. We have 28 years in August. And you think about it, that's awesome. And the only reason that it's there, well, and our children now, Angie's, I got two grandsons from my oldest daughter, one who wanted to kill herself. One day she came to me and said, you know that little kid you don't like, that little guy? I said, yeah. She said, I'm going to marry him. And I said, that's good. But you guys had taught me to keep my nose out of her business. And she said, would you walk me down the aisle? And I said, Angie, I want to say something before I do that because I think you don't have to ask me. It's okay. We've been through a lot together. She said, Dad, you're my father, and I want you to love me. I'm so proud of you. You are Dad. And that's a gift I got from you guys. I didn't know how to be a father, a husband, a friend, an employee, employer, any of those things. I came in here, and I watched each one of you guys go through the good and the bad and come out on the other side, sometimes sadly and sometimes happily. And that's how I learned. I read the big book. I was telling somebody this morning. I read it, and I walk away going, wow, what did I read? I remember little parts, but I got a lot of brain damage. You know, you keep getting those cop clubs and running into walls. After a while, brain cells disappear. So anyway, I got that. I've got the grandsons. You know, I can call my daughter, one of the grandsons fishing or camping with me, right out of school, no questions asked. And I'll say, well, there's school. No, no, Dad, I want them to have time with you. Wow. My middle daughter, you know, she went through anorexia bulimia. She wasn't going to be a drunk like her dad, so she went a different route. Now she's in college, and she wants to work with kids on that subject. I got a granddaughter from her. Oh, if any of you guys ain't got grandkids, is that cool? Fill them full of sugar, send them home. Because you can always make an amend later, you know. That's the beauty of it. That's the beauty. And my son, James, 26 years old. He was a professional kickboxer and stuff like that. And I live in fear that one of these days, one of his brain cells is going to kick off. And he's going to remember them threats I used to give him when he was 7 years old. I'll kick your ass, boy. Think about it. Man. Well, God's being cool. He said, let's have a little break there. I never kissed my son when I was drinking. Never kissed him once. Hardly hugged him. I watched you guys, and through my sponsor and my friends, they taught me it's okay to kiss your son. It doesn't make him a decision. It'll probably help him be a man someday. You know, and he come up to me, and now he's 20, I guess 6 years old, big, and before we left, and he said, Dad, have a nice trip. Okay, and I give him a big kiss, and he gave me a kiss. You know, is that nice? That's one of the gifts. I used to push him away. Get away. You're a man. Let's punch. Let's be man. You know, he's getting married now. That'll be a thrill. I always said to God, all I want to do is see my son have children. Now he's getting close. I'm thinking, okay, God, let's change that. About 6 months ago, I had a chance to do a 12-step call on my son. He called me, my daughter called me and said, James is over here and he's just hammered on cocaine and I don't know what to do. She has her own house, a new baby, her husband, one of those that doesn't understand us. And he's watching my son through the house. Anyway, and I said, yeah. And my son knew by going to her, she would call me. And I said, oh, my wife was down in Texas, her dad was dying. And I went over and got him, brought him back to the house. Now, I've been a lot of 12-step calls in my life because I usually deal with drugs. I mean, alcoholics. Boy, you get a cocaine addict. Jesus Christ. I thought I'd go in the back room, get my fishing net out and get the sucker. Right. Give me a wino any day. They're just there for you, you know. Hello. Cocainers, man. Man. But anyway, and I'm doing the father thing, you see, and I'm telling him yes. And before you know it, I'm buying in. I'm saying, you know, even I don't got no Al-Anon training, so I'm just buying in. And I'm saying, yeah, you did that. Oh, yeah. And all of a sudden, one of you guys in this room or somewhere in AA spoke to me. And I swear to God in my head, this voice said, you don't have the right to kill him. And I stopped and I realized, no, I have to talk AA and 12-step to him. Not Daddy. And I get one shot. So I just started talking and, you know, it went well. He quit doing cocaine. He's drinking now. He just changed his seat on the Titanic. He just moved over. But whom? I'm there, you know. He said something to me that irritated me and got me mad. And then I realized I don't blame him. I said, cocaine, son. You've been around this program, you know, with me and the wife and everything. Why cocaine? And he said, I didn't want to be a drunk like you, Dad. And for a second, of course, And then I remember, I didn't want to be a drunk like my father either. You know, I don't blame him. So we'll see what happens. Right now, I understand he's working his seat. He'll be at one of these someday. But, you know, and God will have it happen in his time. But we've been pretty fortunate. And I have a very good life right now. And all it is because of this program, Alcoholics Anonymous. The spiritual side, the steps, the books, and the people. I don't know how to say thank you enough times or anything. So I kind of like this. There's one thing I know, two things I know. Is I can't stay sober by myself. I can't stay sober without spirituality, and I can't stay sober without you guys. And the other thing I do know for sure is that if I'd known my last drink was my last drink, I would not have gone out on Mad Dog 2020. Which I had my wife convinced and then 20 out of 20 doctors approved of it. The last thing I like to do, I always end the speech or talk, whatever this is, with a little story I heard up in Canada. And I stole it from a guy in Canada, so it's okay. You know, if he's here, I apologize. But I always do because it tells me how this program works. And the way it goes is this. When I was in my youth and I was out there running and gunning, I was running around doing tricks and drinking and everything. And one day, I came to a fork in the road in my life, and there was an old-timer standing there, and I said, hey, old-timer, which way do I go, left or right? And he said, Jesus, don't go left. There's a big gorilla there, and he'll jump out of that tree and smack you around. He said, go right. There's a bunch of nice people that will help you out in your life. Well, you know me. I looked at it and thought, I like gorillas. So I went up the left side, and sure as heck, this gorilla come out, and it hurt me. It beat me up bad, and I went down and went back up the right-hand side, and I met these people, really, really nice people, kind of odd. They met in little places all over town, and they had little God words now and then, but they were nice, and they were sober, and they didn't seem to have a lot of problems, but I couldn't hang there much longer. I had big things to do, so I went back out, and I was drinking, doing. I came to another fork in the road, and there's that old-timer standing there, and I said, hi, old-timer. I said, which way do I go? And, of course, there's an old-timer. He just shook his head and said, don't go left. There's a gorilla. Go right. You can have a better way of life. And I said, yeah, right. I know that trick. I'm a con man. You switch them, gorilla. Now it's on the right. And then I went up. You know what? Left side was this gorilla. Jumped out of the tree and it just hurt me. I came back, went up the right side. And this time, I know, I kind of hung with those people. I started going to their meetings and drinking coffee till 2, 3 in the morning. And I started feeling really good about myself for the first time. But I had a little pressure and I went back out again. And I was drinking, doing my thing. And I come to another fork in the road. And there was this old-timer there, and he's shaking his head this time, you know. And I said, which way do I go, left or right? And he said, don't go left. There's a gorilla. Go right. There's a new way of life. And I said, you know something? I got one shot left, and I'm going left. And I went up the left side, and sure as hell, this gorilla come out and just hurt me. But I came back around to the right side, and I stayed with those people this time. I did those things they call the steps. I learned about a guy named God. I started doing things that were so wonderful in my life. My life was coming together, my family, finding everything. And I come to another fork in the road, and I thought, what am I doing at a fork in the road? I'm standing there looking, and all of a sudden I hear a voice say, hey, old-timer, which way do I go, left or right? My God. Thank you.